Thank you, Brother Dylan. And now, I'll ask Brother Tim to step forward and present his fourth class in the series entitled, Know His Sovereignty. Brother Tim?
Well, good evening, everyone. Well, this is a good little topic for us to think about tonight. So far, we've considered Hosea, the love of God, that Hosea is trying to get the people to understand, for them to know his love, to help them to be drawn away from their sins and their way of life currently at the moment before Assyria comes down and destroys them. And Hosea has also told the people about God's difficulty, that he wrestles and he struggles when he sees his people going astray, when he sees his people fickle between who they're going to serve, when he sees young people that aren't quite willing to really be fully committed to him. He wants to help. He wants to see that happen, but we see a difficulty in God struggling with knowing that our sins are wrong and knowing that God has and will and always has done judged sin, because he has no part with sin, and he wants his people to have no part with sin either. So God in his righteousness and justice will deal with that and judge that, but he struggles because of the things that that means for his people. But tonight what we want to look at is another thing that is one of the core issues when we come to Hosea, and that is for the people to know who is sovereign in their life. And by that, what we mean, and sovereign's not a word that's in Hosea, okay, but what we mean by sovereign is who's really in control of your life. Who is the ultimate being to whom you're responsible and to whom you give praise and worship, and who will control and be with you in your life and give you the things that you need. And we're going to have to develop this as we go this evening. You're going to have to to stay with me, because the practical will more come towards the end as we build this picture of what's here. But it's hard for us to get the actual feeling of what the problem was, because one of the big problems here was idolatry. And we sort of seem to disconnect ourselves with idolatry. We don't have a Baal, a cow, a calf that was in Dan and Bethel right at the start that followed all the way through. We just don't have that sort of same slant on false worship. But the people certainly did, okay? And it was absolutely rife everywhere through Israel at the time. And we're going to see how Hosea picks that up. And that's one thing. That one of the issues in Hosea in terms of sovereignty was, they didn't really know who God was, okay? So they're confusing him with Baal and all these other kind of cults and religions that they'd got from Syria and Egypt and all this kind of mishmash. And the other thing is they didn't know who was king. Okay, so let's just start off by pointing out these two key themes in Hosea in terms of who's sovereign as God and king in their life. And the big question was, who is God? And the second one is, who is king? Okay, now, the interesting thing is, Hosea, when you read through his prophecy, keeps mentioning place names in Israel's geography, okay? And people have actually called Hosea the historical geographer of the prophets. Because if you go through, you can make a list of 20-some-odd places he names by name in Israel. And he goes through these towns, and he says that this town's wrong, this town's doing false worship. He lists all these places. One of the key ones is Bethel, okay? And he kind of gives it a nasty little nickname. And the nickname he gives Bethel is Beth-Aven. Let's just have a close look at where this is in the record. Come to chapter, chapter 4, verse 15. You can't read Hosea and not notice that he keeps referring to these place names in Israel. Okay, so here's an example. We won't go through them all. 4, verse 15. Though you, Israel, play the harlot, let not Judah offend. Do not come up to Gilgal, nor go up to Beth-Aven, nor swear an oath saying, as Yahweh lives, because they were totally confused about who Yahweh was, and they were merging it with Baal. But he calls this place Beth-Aven. And young people, Beth Aven, well, what does Beth mean? Do you guys know that? The basic house. Okay, and Bethel means? Okay, house of God. And when you think Bethel, what Bible character do you think comes to mind? Yeah, Jacob. Interestingly, he's in the prophecy of Hosea. We're going to see why that's true, okay, and why that's the case. But Bethel was normally the house of God. But if you lived in Israel this time and you cruised down to Bethel, you would find nothing about God in Bethel. What you would find is a major center of idolatry and totally immoral practices, because the people were in this huge fervor of false pagan worship. And they had Baals set up in Bethel. It was one of the big centers of false worship. So Hosea could hardly refer to Bethel as the house of God. Now he calls it a nasty little nickname, and it's called Beth Aven. And Beth Aven, if you scribble this down, means house of nothing, or house of wickedness, or house of vanity. Can have all those connotations. So at this time in Israel's history, Bethel is far, guys, far from the house of God. This is a house of rottenness, of wickedness, of absolute nothing, of vanity. That's what Bethel is. He's called it now Beth Aven. And he calls it that several times. Just note these down. Chapter 4, verse 15. And if you're just jotting these down, chapter 5, verse 8. He calls it Beth Aven as well. Blow the ram's horn in Gibeah, the trumpet in Ramah, cry aloud at Beth Aven. Okay, and people all knew what that meant. It's related to the word Abel, which means vanity. So Aven, this vanity or wickedness. So, wow, he's calling it the house of wickedness and vanity, which is pretty severe claim. So he does that again in 10 verse 5, okay, if you noticed that when we were reading through. But he does refer to Bethel at times in the record. And I'll just point this out to you so we know that it's in here. Have a look at 10 verse 15, okay? This is one of the instances where he does point out Bethel as its proper name. Verse 15, thus it shall be done to you, O Bethel, because of your great wickedness. Do you get that? So he's just told you the definition of Bethel is called the house of wickedness or the house of vanity because of the terrible things that are going on there. So you need to get that impression. And this is the background to Hosea. That's what's happening in the land. And he has a lot to say about that place. Now, the question is then, who is God? And Bethel is the key place for that. Do you remember what Jeroboam the son of Nebat did? He couldn't be stuffed going down to Jerusalem to worship at the temple. So he set up two places, one in Bethel and one in Dan, so people didn't have to walk there. And he set up these golden calves, right? And this is a little picture I think is just so amazing of that time. Set up the golden calf, captures all the drama that's there. People don't have to go to Jerusalem anymore to worship. They can come to Bethel and they've got calves to worship. And he goes right back to the time of Moses when Aaron brings out the calf and says, this is your God, Israel, who delivered you from Egypt. He's going right back to the time of Moses and Aaron at the Mount Sinai. And he sets one of these up in Bethel and one in Dan, okay? So that's one of the serious issues here. The other issue is this, okay? And you might have noticed in verse 10 of chapter 10, if you just come there, actually, sorry, not verse 10, verse 3. Have a look at chapter 10, verse 3. The other issue is who is king, okay? So who's God? Linked to Bethel and Beth Aven. Who's king? Look at this. Verse 3. For now they say, we have no king, because we did not fear Yahweh. And as for a king, what would he do for us? So you've got this totally messed up situation in Israel, where kings are coming and going, assassins are destroying people and killing each other left, right, and center. There's no stability. One guy reigns for 6 months, for 1 month. Next guy, it's all totally up in the air and totally out of whack. And the people have no idea who's sovereign king in their life, to the point where they're saying, we don't even need kings because they're idiots anyway, and they're not doing anything for us. So you've got this big issue, and that's why in chapter 13, verse 10, we looked at that ambiguous thing where it says, I will be your king, or it could be, who is your king? There's a huge issue with kings at the moment, and they don't know. Now, interestingly, when you read through Hosea, you keep reading of these places, Ramah, Gibeah, and Gilgal. What's the link? Let's just have a look at a few examples first, okay, just really quickly. Chapter 4, verse 15. Right, just as a quick example, if you want the rest of these, I can give them to you. Chapter 4, verse 15, Though you, Israel, play the harlot, let not Judah offend. Do not come up to Gilgal. So Gilgal is associated with these crimes. If you come to chapter 9, verse 15. I just want you to get this impression that he's all about the historical geography here. What's happening? Verse 15. All their wickedness is in Gilgal, for there I hated them because of the evil deeds that they've done. So, whoa, what's happening in Gilgal and what's it's associated with? Well, the other place is Gibeah, and I'll just give you one of those. Chapter 10, it's in our chapter we read tonight. Verse 9. O Israel, you have sinned. This is 10 verse 9. You sinned from the days of Gibeah. There they stood, the battle in Gibeah against the children of iniquity. So there's Gibeah, Gilgal, and Ramah is also here in chapter 5, verse 8. Come back to chapter 5, verse 8. So we're just flicking around to give you this impression. 5, verse 8. It's got Gibeah in here too, and a few of the places that brings them all together. Look at this. Verse 8. Blow the ram's horn in Gibeah, the trumpet in Ramah, cry aloud at Beth-Aven, and look behind you, O Benjamin. Now, what's the link? He's got this massive issue of kingship. The kings are in disarray, and he keeps going back to the sins of Ramah, Gibeah, and Gilgal. What's the link? That should say something to us, okay? And any thoughts? Yeah, what about Saul? Yeah, he's from Gibeah. Gibeah was the administrative center of Saul's, the first king in Israel. That's the administrative center that Saul had when the people demanded a king. What about Ramah and Gilgal? Okay, Gilgal is where Saul was made king. That's where the first king was made in Israel. And Ramah is when their people demanded a king. So all those three places are totally, and Hosea knows exactly, people know this if you lived in Israel. He keeps having a go at Ramah, Gilead, and Gilgal. That's because that's where the monarchy started. And that's where all the people demanded a king. And now they're saying, we don't even care about kings. We don't need a king. We don't have a king. And God's trying to say, but I'm your king. And it goes right back to the problem in Ramah, Gilead, and Gilgal, with their first king that they demanded, and Hosea's all over that. So those are the two issues in the book. Who's king in your life? And who's your God? Really. And who, when you look at your life, does it reflect the fact that you believe that I'm king in your life? Because it wasn't for the people of Israel. And secondly, does it reflect that you actually believe I'm God? And I'm actually in control? Now, we sort of think, well, let's get back to this, the issue of the gods. Who's your God at Bethel and Beth-Aven? Because that's what we want to focus on tonight, not so much the kingship. Here's what Baal looks like. Okay, these are drawings, a little bit of archaeology. You've probably seen pictures like this before. Baal was a massive issue at the time. And he was all over Bethel. He was up in Dan as well, and all over the cities of Israel at the time. Baal, the Hebrew word for Baal is a pretty generic term. And early on in the history of Israel, it was just a term for lord, master, or husband. You can find it in the scripture record. But later, when people started worshiping this called a whole Canaanite mythology that was headed up by the Baal, the head honcho god, Baal became a dirty word, okay? Because it no longer just meant lord or master or husband. It had this association with the false worship. Now, God's got a problem, young people, with people of Israel worshiping Baal, because he is trying to say, I'm your Lord, not this stupid Baal, and I'm your master, not Baal. And he's also desperately, as we've already seen, trying to tell you that he is your husband, not this false Baal. So Baal was all over the place, and people were totally confused. So much so, I want you to just have a look at this. Chapter 2. God actually points this out. This is a massive, massive issue. In chapter 2, it says in verse 16, it shall be in that day, and this is the future when things are going to be right. This is what's going to happen. It shall be in that day, says Yahweh, that you will call me my husband. Hebrew is the word ishi. And you'll no longer call me master or Baal. Now, that should say something to us, because what's happening, you got to get this, the people are worshiping Baal, but they sort of think that they're worshiping God at the same time. So they're calling God Baal, and God's saying, no, don't ever call me Baal again. the time will come where you will call me husband, which is the word ishi, and no longer will you just call me this dirty, rotten word that's associated with all your confusion about me, the word Baal. Now, I want you to grab a pencil or a pen or something and just note this little fact about Hosea, where Baal is mentioned 7 times, okay? And this is going to become really important. Baal is mentioned right there in chapter 2, verse 17. So just note this is another theme like the knowledge of God. In fact, it's totally in the same line. 2, verse 17, Baal is mentioned. And if you just go back to 2, verse 8, is the first time he's mentioned. So just have a look in verse 8. At the very end, which they prepared for Baal. 2 verse 13, he's mentioned. I will punish her for the days of the Baals to which she burned incense. And this is serious business, right? This is, you can't really understand Hosea if we don't get this idea of Baal and what he's doing. Verse 16. We got that one, sorry. And that's the word master in the English. I think that's in the King James Version as well. That's actually literally Baal. Verse 17, I will take from her mouth the names of the Baals, and there was loads of them. There's Baal of Peor, there's Baal of Carmel, there's Baal of Berith. There's all these ridiculous Baals, and he's manifested in all these different ways to bring together all these ridiculous false gods into one head. He's going to go to take away all of those Baal names. So that's verse 17. Come to 9 verse 10. He's mentioned there too, worth highlighting. 9 verse 10. That's Baal of Peor. Halfway through the verse, they went to Baal Peor and separated themselves to that shame. 11 verse 2. As they called them, so they went from them, they sacrificed to Baals and burned incense to carved images. So that's the next one, 11 verse 2. And the last one's in 13 verse 1. Okay. When Ephraim spoke, 13 verse 1, trembling, he exalted himself in Israel, but when he offended through Baal worship, he died. Okay, so you get the impression he is absolutely on this mission to cut Baal out of that culture and get them back to God. That's a really important part of his mission. All right, so you just think about this, and this is also important to understand with Hosea, because everyone knew it. What was Baal responsible for? If you were worshiping Baal, what were you doing? Well, this is what you're doing. You're going to the shrines, and you were praying to Baal that he would bring you crops, wine, and all sorts of other, any type of crop. I'm just going to list them all, but crops, and more crops, okay? That's what he was. He was the god at the top of fertility. And the way they saw it in their psyche, we're not going to go into a lot of detail because there's not need to, but you need to know the basics, because Hosea touches on it all the time. They believed that Baal was male and the earth was female, and the fertility that they had together was the crops and the wine that they got. Got that? That's how they worshiped Baal. They thought that he was the source of all their wine and their crops and their water and everything else. All their material possessions came from Baal. Now, when you have that in your head and you read through Hosea, he has a go at that on almost every page. Watch this, okay? You just have a look. And this is why it opens up a whole other dimension to this prophecy. Hosea chapter 2. Look at what Gomer's doing, who's a type of Israel. Verse 5. Their mother has played the harlot. 2 verse 5. She's behaved shamefully. She said, I will go after my lovers. Now, for Gomer, that was real people. For Israel, it's all the other nations and their false religions. Look what it says. Who will give me my bread, my water, and Baal was the god of rain as well. He'd bring the rain to get the crops. Who will give me my bread, my water, my wool, my linen, my oil, and my drink? Do you get that? Is a total having a go at their understood idea of who Baal was. And he's saying, Gomer's going after all these other men, and that's where she gets her water and her wine and her wool and all those things. And God's having a total crack at the god Baal, which they worship, the fertility god who brings the rains, gets the crops. And so, verse 8, this makes sense, right, in this context. They didn't know that I gave her grain, new wine, and oil, and multiplied her silver and gold, which they gave to Baal. So this is a massive issue, guys. Who is it that provides for you? Who is it that gives you what you have? Where does that come from? It's not your own strength, and it's not this ridiculous Baal god that you're serving. He doesn't give you water in the time of season and crops and all those things. It's me, and you don't know that. And this is the question, that you need to know his sovereignty, that he, young people, provides everything for you. And the modern day equivalent to us is not, we don't go out to the grocery store and worship Baal because of all the goodies in the grocery store. But what this is in reality saying, young people, is that these people weren't really reflecting the fact that they depended on God for everything. They were taking things into their own hands or attributing the blessings in their life to something else and hadn't really tuned into the fact that God gives them every blessing they ever get. And to not acknowledge that God does that for us is to not know who God is in our life, that he is the sovereign Lord and provider of everything we have. That was the issue for the people. You know, this is absolutely amazing. He has another crack in chapter 2 at the end. Listen to this, okay? Come with me. And he's talking about the future. And once you understand Baal and what's happening here, you got it. Verse 21. It shall come to pass, chapter 2, in that day that I will answer, says Yahweh. Now listen, this is what happens, okay? I will answer the heavens, and they shall answer the earth. And the earth shall answer with grain, wine, and oil, and they will answer Jezreel. Now that is a total reversal of everything the people believed in. Let me just explain what's happening here. Jezreel goes for the people, okay? There's the people living in Jezreel. It's actually a play on the word of Israel. Israel calls out to their crops. They're like, give us good crops this year, please. Wine, corn, oil, all those things, right? And then the crops cry out to the earth, to the soil, saying, give us good nutrients. And Baal's all involved in that. He's in control of all that. So the earth gives nutrients to the plants, but the earth cries out to the heavens. What's the earth crying out for? Water. Is that what you said? Yep. Water. And the heavens answer, right? But God's saying, no, you've got it totally wrong. I am at the very top. And when the heavens ask for rain, because the earth asked for it, and the earth asked for it because the crops are asking the earth to give good soil, and the people are asking the crops to give good crops, I'm at the very top, I will answer the heavens, and then the heavens will answer the earth, and then the earth will answer with crops, and the crops will give them to the people who first asked for them. And I am at the very top of that chain. I provide everything. And in that day, in the future, you'll get that. That I provide for you in every respect. And that's the people, that's what they needed to know. And that is totally flying in the face of their false Baal worship. So when you read through the rest of Hosea, we're going to end with a verse. That's what he's having a crack at, for people to understand that he is in full control of their life. Every single aspect of blessing, of drought, of whatever. And they thought Baal was the god of rain and all the rest of it. Now, this is where I'm just going to skip ahead. I have a handout that I'm going to give to you at the end, so you don't have to Bible mark what we're going to do in the next 5-10 minutes, okay? Well, you can. You can do it after, though. You don't have to scramble down. Show you, young people, that there is an issue or a Bible echo happening right the way through Hosea that brings this practical down to us in terms of this whole wrestling with Baal. And that is going to start with chapter 7, verse 14. Okay, I want you to have a look at this, because this is the issue of finding out who's sovereign, who the righteous God of all the earth is, and who provides all these things. Hosea chapter 7, verse 14. And this is actually referring to the whole rituals with Baal worship, where they would cry out to Baal. 7 verse 14. They did not cry out to me with their heart when they wailed upon their beds. Okay, now this is having a go at what people would do. They'd stand in front of Baal, their god, and cry out and wail and howl for Baal to bring rains and good crops, right? That's what they would do. And the people have actually gone so far as that they think they're actually crying out to Yahweh at the same time. They've totally confused who's God. Now look what it says. They assemble together for grain and new wine. Now you know why it says that. They rebel against me. Does anyone have another translation for verse 14 at the end? That doesn't say just they assemble together? Or anyone have a marginal note? Yep. No? I don't know. Do you? Okay, just before that, when it says, mine says they assemble together, is there anything different in your translation? Okay. James? How do you... Someone at the back, Mom? They cut themselves. Where'd you get that from? Yeah, the RV. Okay. My margin says they slashed themselves. Okay, so other, and this is what the word can mean. The people are crying out and they're cutting themselves, crying out to the god Baal to give them rain and all that. What does that remind you of? Should remind you of this, okay? And all the way through Hosea is the work and the mission of the prophet Elijah. Hosea is what I would call the great successor to the prophet Elijah. He is fighting exactly the same battle from chapter 1 to chapter 14. And there's a reference in here exactly what the people were doing on Mount Carmel in 1 Kings chapter 17 and 18. Slashing themselves, crying out to Baal. This is the issue. Seven times Baal's referred to, and way more times with carved images and calves and all the rest of it. This is a reference to the life of Elijah. Now, I want to walk you through this just so you're impressed with what Hosea is doing, because it is actually really exciting, okay? Now, these are references, okay, that are going to link Elijah into the prophecy of, no, it's not a G, okay? This is Elijah in the prophecy of Hosea. And it just adds this whole other dimension. 7 verse 14 is our little clue to this whole Mount Carmel incident. Have a look at chapter 2, verse 16, okay? You can jot those down, but I've got them on the handout at the end as well, so you're not going crazy. Chapter 2, verse 16, okay? As we've looked at, this is the exact issue in 1 Kings chapter 17 and 18. It shall be in that day, says Yahweh, that you will call me my husband, Ishi, and no longer call me master of Baal. And this is what the problem is in the link to the life of Elijah. The people had confused Yahweh and Baal and totally mixed them up, so they didn't know who they were calling to. And Elijah was there to tell them, your Baal God is ridiculous, and this is the true God, Yahweh, in your life, who you serve. So 2 verse 16 shows you the confusion that's there in the time of Elijah as well. The next one is in chapter 2 verse 20. Okay, just skip across to chapter 2, verse 20. It fits the whole theme of the book. I will betroth you to me in faithfulness, and you shall know the Lord. When you look at 1 Kings 18, and this is on your handout, so we don't have to skip all over the place tonight. 1 Kings chapter 18, Elijah says this, that this people may know that you are Yahweh God. And that was the whole point of the Mount Carmel incident, that people will actually know who God is. And that's exactly what Hosea is onto. And look at verse 21 of chapter 2. It shall come to pass in that day that I will answer, says Yahweh. What was the issue on Mount Carmel? The issue was, who's going to answer? And Baal didn't do, maybe he's sleeping, maybe he's tired. Remember all that? That he's doing nothing. And it says that I will answer, and God answered on that day. And the little echo of the words of the people is saying, oh Baal, hear us, hear us. And no one answered. That's what it said. But God says in Hosea, and just like Elijah demonstrated, I am alive, I'm sovereign, and I answer when you call to me. So we come down to Hosea chapter 11, verse 7. Just have a look at this one. This is really interesting. I'm just going to build this picture because this is one of the themes in Hosea. Chapter 11, verse 7. And this is one of those verses that's a little bit hard to translate. You'll find some variations, but here's the gist of it. Verse 7, my people are bent on apostasy or backsliding from me. Though they call to the Most High, none at all exalt him. Now when it says, my people are bent on backsliding to me, does anyone have any other translations for that? My people are bent on backsliding to me. Slightly different, yes, any page?
Bent on turning away from
me. Bent on turning away from me, okay, good. This is the gist of it. People are trying to translate the weird Hebrew language at this point. Young's literal says, my people are hanging in suspense because they keep either turning away from me, turning back to me, and all over the place. And literally, the Hebrew means that they're hung up, as if they're suspended in air and they don't know what they're doing. And they continually turn from God by doing that. And the NEB at the end says, though they call on their high God. Okay? So that is exactly what's happening on Mount Carmel. This is a reference to Elijah and the people's same issue way back in the time of Elijah, that they're hung up in suspense. They're halting between two opinions. Right? Look at chapter 6, verse 5. Let's build this picture. Chapter 6, verse 5. Therefore, I have hewn them by the prophets. What's the link to the life of Elijah? I mean, this is almost a direct reference to Elijah without mentioning his name. I've hewn them by the prophets. Okay? He took the prophets of Baal and he executed them there. That's what it says in 1 Kings chapter, where are we? In 1 Kings chapter 18, verse 40, it says, Elijah said to them, seize the prophets of Baal. Do not let one of them escape. So they seized them, and Elijah brought them down to the brook Kishon and executed them there. And Hosea picks that up and says, I've slain them by the prophets and by the words of my mouth as well. So that's another one. Let's just build the picture a little bit further. If you come to chapter 2, verse 8, these are things that we've looked at. That God is the one who provides the corn and the oil and all those things, right? We've got that. Specifically oil. Now you think about this. Right before the Mount Carmel incident, does anyone know what was happening in the miracles of Elijah? What was he doing? Should we go back there? Let's go. Okay, come with me to 1 Kings chapter 17. Right before the Mount Carmel incident, and people, the Baal God had done all the same things back then. He was known for fertility and providing oil and everything else. All that was celebrated to Baal. Right before the Mount Carmel incident, where Baal is dashed to pieces in that sense, is the incident with the widow. And she ran out of something. What did she run out of? Oil. And what was the point of what Elijah did? Oh, there's the spiritual lessons in there too, about the word of God. But the whole thing is, that oil just kept coming and kept coming. She filled up all the jars of her own household and all of her neighbor's jars. She went and got them all that oil just filling up until they were all full. And she lived on that for the rest of her life. And the point is, that lady would have gone away and saying, who the heck's Baal? This is the God who actually provides oil and corn and wine and all these things. He is the provider of all these sustenance and provisions. And that's the issue right before Mount Carmel takes place. And that's the issue that's all the way through Hosea, who's the provider. And God makes that clear, it's him. Do you know the other thing that's true? In Hosea chapter 2, verse 3, it says, lest I make her. Have a look at chapter 2 and keep your hand in 1 Kings, because we'll just quickly come back there. There's so many things here. Hosea chapter 2, verse 3, lest I make her like a wilderness, at the very end of that verse, and set her like a dry land and slay her with thirst. What's the link to the life of Elijah? Slay, pardon? Yeah. Totally, right? That's what Elijah brings on. He prays and there's no dew or rain for 3.5 years. And this is exactly what Hosea picks up on and says, that's what I'm going to do to you people again. I will be the one who takes that rain from you. You think Baal provides it? Wrong. I do. And we prove that in the days of Elijah, but you need to learn it again. Your dependency is on me as your sovereign God. There is no other God like me. And that's all coming from the life of Elijah. But there's one more, okay? And this is amazing. I want you to come to 1 Kings chapter 18, we're going to join Elijah on the mountain, on the contest, and he adds this little note, and I'm not sure if you've ever noticed it before, but it's absolutely amazing. Chapter 18 of 1 Kings, verse 31. Have a look at this. Elijah took 12 stones. This is chapter 18, verse 31. According to the number of the tribes of the sons of Jacob, to whom, just by the way, to whom the word of Yahweh had come saying, Israel shall be your name. Now, you ever thought about that, young people? Why is it that Elijah's on Mount Carmel, engaged in this battle with this fake god, and he builds this altar, and he says, this is according to the number of the tribes of Jacob. By the way, just in case you remember, this is the man who God changed his name from Jacob to Israel. Just by the way. And then he continues on with the context. Why would you do that? Any thoughts? Why did he suddenly bring up the life of Jacob and the fact that his name was changed on Mount Carmel? When surely there's bigger issues going on here than just remember. You got to think about that. There's something happening. Any ideas? Okay, I'm going to ask you the same question about why Hosea does exactly the same thing. Come to Hosea chapter 12. Okay, he does exactly what Elijah did on Mount Carmel. Hosea chapter 12, verse 2. And this is so something to cross-reference when you get a chance. Verse 2, Yahweh brings a charge against Judah and will punish Jacob according to his ways. According to his deeds, he will recompense him. And he suddenly, and we're going to look at this if we have time today, maybe tomorrow, he launches in suddenly to the life of Jacob at this point in his prophecy. And he says, and he took his brother by the heel in the womb, and in his strength he struggled with God. Yes, he struggled with the angel and prevailed. And he wept and he sought favor from him and he found him in Bethel and there he spoke to us. That is, Yahweh, God of hosts, Yahweh is his memorial name. So you, by the help of your God, return, observe mercy and justice and wait on your God continually. Now, what happened and what was the event when God wrestled, when Jacob wrestled with the angel? What happened right there and then? That was when his name was changed from Jacob to Israel, young people. That's exactly the same point of reference that Elijah brings up on Mount Carmel, just by the way, right? And if you're, I'm going to have to restrain myself. We won't do it now, but if you're interested, I'll show you after. Hosea has the name changed poetically in a pun right in this verse. When it says, he took his brother, I just told you I wasn't going to, but anyway. This is good. He took his brother by the heel in the womb, and in his strength, he struggled with God. And that word strength is to have power. It means to be a prince, and it's Jacob's other name, Israel. It's a pun on that name, and it's taken right from Genesis where that pun is originally found. Okay? So he's referring to both names of Jacob. Now, young people, but I want you to think about it. Why is Hosea in the battle against Baal referring to the change of name that Jacob had in his life? And why did Elijah do exactly the same thing? Why is that the case? Any guesses? And there's no wrong. Really is, but that's just a nice way of getting people involved. What do you think? Why are they both doing this? Hosea is totally bent on the life of Elijah and his mission. He takes it up. Yes, I agree with that. This is the God of Israel. And there it was pronounced for the first time. Your name shall be Israel. Yep, I'll be your God. Yeah, okay, that's one. There's a couple angles on that. I'm not nicely saying that's wrong. Okay, that's good. There's a couple of angles here, and I think it's filled out. The more you think about it, the more there's a lot of reasons. Any other ideas? I mean, they both talk about the name change incident where he's wrestling with the angel. Why? One, this is where the God of Israel's found. Yep.
That's where he was going back to see Esau.
Yes.
He was afraid of his face, and so he kept trying to supplant it, to do his own thing.
Yep.
And that's where he became halted with his side and realized he couldn't do it himself.
Totally.
And so if he was weakness, he prevailed with God.
Yep.
Which is why his name changed.
Yes.
And Israel was trying to do it themselves.
Yes. Sorry, keep going.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep.
That's good. So I'll summarize that. Okay. I don't need that. In other words, the comment from the floor was they both realized that they couldn't do it themselves. Oh, sorry. That's what Jacob realized. And Elijah's telling the people, you can't do it yourself. You need God. And Hosea is telling the people the same thing. You can't do it yourself. You depend completely and utterly and entirely on God. You got that? Good. Okay. Okay, there's another little aspect here too. Just fill this out. I believe that's the key issue. Another issue is, what do you guys know about the life of Jacob? And why do you think the prophet Hosea would pick on that patriarch and describe his life? I mean, what was Jacob? We just had that comment. Jacob was a man who wasn't really depending on God. He was kind of worked in his own ways, right? He was cunning and scheming, kind of work out his own way, right? What else do you know about Jacob's relationship with God? Was he a total firm believer from birth to death? It was so extreme. No. What do you mean, James? Why not? How do you know that?
Because he has he sort of goes back and forth.
He totally does.
With the later thing where he's trying to get the cow to
bear. No. I was told to angle it at the audience. Yes, go ahead.
So he has these sheep and these goats, and the deal is he gets the spotted one. So then it talks about how that he makes these sticks and puts it in front of their breeding ground so that they are spotted because they've spotted sticks and whatever.
Yep.
But then a little bit later he's like, and it's very clear that God was the one who was making this happen.
Yeah.
So he's trying to depend on his own sort of abilities, but it ends up being God who actually delivers them. But he keeps going back and forth between, is it me who's doing it or is it God who's doing it?
Yeah, that's beautiful, okay? In other words, when you read through the life of Jacob, and we don't have time to study him now, but when you read through the life of Jacob, it's halting between two opinions. Over here, God's with me, and the next moment you find him, I'm not sure if God's with me, I want you to prove it to me. And then when you go to Bethel, he says, surely God is in this place, and I didn't know it. So there's this whole battle in Jacob's life, and the battle is who is God in his life. That's what's happening in the life of Jacob. He struggles to hang on to God. And it says in chapter 12, he found him at Bethel. And he's telling the people in no uncertain terms, this is absolutely ridiculous. The Bethel is a headquarters, and I'm going to call it Beth-Aven because it can't even be called Bethel. This is a headquarters for apostasy and people not finding God and confusing God, who he really. Look back in your own history and you will find a patriarch who struggled to find me, but he found me in Bethel. And there's no one in this nation that can find me in Bethel anymore. And Jacob was a classic illustration of the attitude that the Israelites were going through at this time. They couldn't find God and they were struggling to find him. But Jacob did in the end. And if you persevere and if you pursue the knowledge of God from chapter 6, you'll find me. And Jacob did, and he's a classic illustration of that. And it goes right back to Mount Carmel. That's why Elijah brought him up on Mount Carmel. Here's, by the way, this is Jacob who was renamed Israel, because right at that point, he was struggling to find God. And you guys are too. And I'm going to show you right now that he is the God of everything. And the stupid Baal isn't going to answer anything, but the Yahweh of all the earth will. And he's alive and powerful. See, young people, I want you to... Hosea is absolutely astonishing. All the way through, there's this undercurrent of the life of Elijah. He picks up his mission, and to the very point where he picks up the life of Jacob in exactly the same way and shows the people that Jacob was an illustration of them and he's finding God. Do you know what's also amazing? When Jacob ended up at Bethel, what was the thing he did finally in Bethel? He told the people, we're getting rid of our idols. And that, if the people had followed the story through, they would have got the message that Jacob ditched the idols finally in the end, and all the people he got to do that. Do you know what it says at the very end of the book? In chapter 14? In other words, Jacob at the end is like, hey, what do we have to do with idols anymore? We need to get rid of them all. And they do that in Genesis. The very end of this book, young people, says in verse 8, Ephraim shall say, what have I any more to do with idols? And another way of saying that, another way of reading it, is that it's God speaking, saying, Israel and Ephraim, what have I any more to do with idols? I'm not anything to do with idols. So there's two ways of reading that. I personally think it is Ephraim saying that first bit. But either way, the point is exactly the same. Idol and idolatry means nothing to us. Look at the life of Jacob. Look at Elijah in the proof that I was there. I think people, we sort of think, well, that's an amazing issue. But our idols, you know, what's the lesson from Mount Carmel? What's the lesson from Hosea for these people? Is idols really relevant to us? And it totally is. You know, people have said that an idol that was plaguing these people like Baal is anything that takes you away from God. And that's a simplified version, I think, of something that's totally true. That idols do take you away from God in every little sense of that word, in whatever. The other way you could put it is idols are things that we or the things that we like. And people liked Baal because they saw him as providing all this stuff. And Baal was symbolized by this cow, right? And the cow to the people back then, more to us, more to them than it does us, cow stood for strength and fertility. Now, young people, Hosea is going to talk to you straight. He, time and again, through his prophecy, condemns the people for idolizing sexual immorality. That is a massive part of what the Baal contest that he's continuing on from Elijah was all about. He is telling the people that you have idolized this and all the other things that go with Baal to the point where you don't know who I am anymore. You know, that puts it in perspective, young people, to say that idolatry in the old Canaanite way, in what Israel was caught up with this at that time, probably isn't so far removed from us today. Because it's exactly those two things, like strength and fertility or sexual immorality, that is totally idolized in the world today. And it's something that have taken people away from God and away from their dependency on Him and their devotion to Him. The world is completely caught up in that sense with Baal worship. No one sees that God provides all these things, but they look to fulfillment and satisfaction in all the other immoral practices, anything but God. You know, that actually ended up taking the people away. We know from Baal Peor that he refers to in other places that that's exactly what happened. And it starts, young people, with little things. And it grows in your life to the point where I think in the time of Hosea, Hosea would have been telling them the message, guys, what are you doing? And people would have been right over their head like, what's wrong with it? There's nothing wrong with it. This is God. Like, we're still praying and we're still crying out. We might be slashing ourselves a little bit, but that's all part of how we get grain and wine and oil. And Hosea's like, no, you're totally off track. You go back and struggle to find God and persevere and find Him. Young people, that's a challenge for us. When you think about there's things in our lives like idols that we like, and they slowly take the place of God. Now, you might have, this is a cliche thing to say about idolatry, but I want you tonight and this weekend, because it's a major theme of Hosea who we're studying, to go back into your life and to find out the things that are taking your devotion away from God. And you know, an idol is, because we like it, we tend to sacrifice to it, right? An idol is almost always associated with sacrifice. So people would sacrifice, you know, their food. They'd bring the best of their corn, which was really supposed to go to God. They'd sacrifice everything. But if we make the modern parallel, there's things that you sacrifice to, and I do too in my life. And sacrifice just as simple as, well, we put it this way, okay? This is a little list. Money might not be totally relevant to you guys yet. But idols receive sacrifices. And when you start putting it in those terms, you realize that maybe there are some little idols in my life, things that I idolize, that take my time or my thoughts and my devotion and sometimes even money when it gets to that point. And young people, you just got to ask yourself, are there little things in my life that I'm giving those things to, that I'm making sacrifices for? And you got to ask your question, well, where are those things leading me? Because you know what? This is an amazing thing when you look at it, and we won't explore it in great depth. But when people started worshiping their idols in the Bible, the end result was that they became like their idol. Now this is, I'll tell you why. Okay, we're painting this picture like stupid Baal, the little dumb idol. He doesn't have, well, he's got a nose, but he can't smell. He's got ears, but he can't hear. He's got feet, but he can't walk. He's got a mouth, but he can't speak. That's all the descriptions of the idols in Scripture. And it's true. Everyone knows that. But do you know what God says of his people eventually? He says, my people have ears, but they won't hear. And they have eyes, but they won't see. And that what's happened is the people have become like their idol. They're so absorbed with it that they lose all sense. You know, Hosea picks up on one of these little messages, and this is, it's awesome that he picks up on this one. I'm just going to show it to you. Let me just find it. He doesn't talk about nose and ears and eyes and all those kind of things, but he does talk about something that he's very interested in this book. And let me just find it. Hold on. Oh, sorry, chapter 4. Sorry. It starts at chapter 4 and verse 11. And I just want you to pick up the little phrase. In chapter 4, verse 11, it says, "Harlotry, wine, and new wine enslaved the heart." So these became the gods, and the gods that gave them all these things. So their heart becomes enslaved to this thing that they're idolizing, or the idols give them, right? Harlotry, wine, and interestingly, not just wine, but new wine, like the tasty good stuff. Okay? And that tends to grab your heart and enslave it. That's what idolatry does. And you can put any, like harlotry, modern equivalent of today, is all the sexual immorality, pornography, everything else that the world loves and that we're trying to stand apart from. Those things grab your heart and enslave it to the point where, and people in the world even tell us this after time on reflection, people in the world tell us this is what happens. Come to chapter 7, and I want you to look at verse 14. Now what's happening is their heart's being enslaved, and now look what's happened, young people. They do not cry out to me with their heart. And the reason is because they don't have one anymore. It's been totally enslaved to other things. And so when they try and pray and cry out to God, their heart is totally wrapped up with other things. It's no longer free to worship God. It's becoming like their idols that have no heart. And that's what happens to people, and that's what happens to us. And what we want to kind of focus on in Hosea's message is look for those things, young people, that can enslave your heart. And try and find those out and return your heart back to God. And that's, I think that there's probably not one of us that could go home and not find something that, we're giving too much of our time to that. We're giving too much of our thought pattern to that. We're giving too much of our action or dedication at school to that, that maybe that is impacting on how close I am to God and how I really see him as the sovereign ruler in my life. Because that was the issue for the people of the day. Let's end on a seriously positive note. Come to chapter 10, back to where we started. We started by looking at the fact that this Baal God was the God of fertility, of water, of rain, of soil and wine and all those things. And God, in an amazing twist, brings it back on the people and shows them what he can do for them if they turn to him. Look at this, chapter 10, verse 12. "Sow for yourselves righteousness. Reap in mercy. Break up your fallow ground. For it is time to seek Yahweh till he comes and he rains righteousness on you." No longer are we concerned about just literal rain and wine and corn. He's basically telling them, if I'm in control of the rain and the crops and everything else, and I can bring fertility and produce and restoration to a land, I need you guys to now think of yourself as those fields in the land of Israel that are lying fallow. And I want you to see yourself as a fallow field that's all crusted over, and it's time to get out the plow and break up that dirt and the fallow ground that's got nothing growing in it. And if you do, you'll reap in mercy and you'll sow righteousness. And not only that, in a total hyperbole, God says, "I'm going to rain righteousness down on you." And young people, that's the tension of God. Because he is a righteous, holy God, he cannot put up with idolatry. He cannot put up with the sins of the people. He is completely and utterly righteous. And when you believe that he's your provider, and when you devote yourself to him as sovereign, and you try and examine yourself and break up those clods of dirt and the fallow ground and start ripping that up, you'll reap in mercy from the Lord God, because he's the provider, not only of literal physical things, but of spiritual things for you in your development. And he'll rain down on you his own righteousness. And that's clearly prophetic of the time to come when that's what he promises he will do. to all of our sins and all of the fallow ground, if we start breaking that up, he'll rain righteousness on us and we'll reap in mercy. And young people, that is an amazing message for a people that he told in chapter 1, I will no longer have mercy on you. But now that we break up our fallow ground and believe that God is sovereign, he will rain righteousness on us in that time to come.